Every Woman is a womanish show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 52% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI board, staff, volunteers or sponsors of KKFI and the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated. Good afternoon. This is Every Woman. I'm Amy Bell here with Sharon Lockhart, and we've got a couple of really great interviews with Voices of the People and the Women's Foundation right after today's Women's E! News.
Cheers. The European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, European Union and Republic of Turkey provide 338 million euros, about $248 million, for female entrepreneurs in Turkey. Daily Sabah reported October 22nd. The program aims to finance 15,000 women-led enterprises across Turkey, while also offering various training and educational services to help women run their companies. More news to cheer this week. 78% of Texas Hispanic voters say a woman has a right to make their own decisions about abortion without politicians interfering, finds an October 22nd study commissioned by the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Rights. The study also finds that most Texas Hispanic voters seem willing to disagree with church leaders on the legality of abortion. The poll finds 76% regard birth control as a part of basic health care and that it should be covered no matter where a woman works. French feminist Caroline Dihas is launching a website, macholand.fr, to denounce and challenge sexism, NPR reported October 17th. The site targets politicians and advertisers. One of them is Gerard Collomb, the mayor of France's second-largest city, Lyon. Collomb recently said that the country's education minister, Najat Vallaud Belkacem, got her job simply because President François Hollande loves beautiful women. The site invites users to join the so-called action against Colomb. Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella said he was completely wrong to suggest that women should not ask for raises, Time reported October 20th. Nadella previously said women should wait for good karma to raise their wages instead of asking directly. After coming under fire, Nadella apologized and reinforced his apology in his latest interview with CNBC. "It's been a very humbling and learning experience for me," said Nadella. A week after a Washington rabbi was charged with videotaping women converting to Judaism as they disrobed for ritual baths, the National Association of Modern Orthodox Rabbis announced that it would require the appointment of ombudswoman to handle any concerns from women about the conversion process. The New York Times reported October 20th. Besides the appointment of ombudswomen, the association would also name a commission that would include women as members to recommend ways to prevent abuses of the conversion process. Jeers. Amid talks of freeing over 200 female hostages they seized in April, suspected Boko Haram members kidnapped at least 25 more girls in an attack on a remote town in northeastern Nigeria, Reuters reported October 23rd. Talks to release the schoolgirls took place this week between the government and a Boko Haram representative in the capital of neighboring Chad. More news to cheer this week. Saudi Arabia's Interior Ministry issued a warning to women not to get behind the wheel in defiance of the kingdom's rules that allow only men to drive, Reuters reported October 23rd. The ministry made the announcement after a renewed social media campaign to challenge the law by driving in public ahead of the October 26th anniversary of a demonstration last year in which dozens of Saudi women took the road in protest of the ban on female drivers, leading to some arrests. As a woman gets heavier, her chances of working in low-paying, physically taxing job grow, according to a study from Jennifer Chenal, a law professor at Vanderbilt University. The Huffington Post reported October 24th, though obese men are more likely than men of average weight to work in lower-paying physical jobs, the effect isn't nearly as strong as it is for women. Obese women make $7 less than their average weight counterparts, while obese men make just $2 less. The wage gap for Latinas living in California is the worst in the country, the National Women's Law Center said October 23rd in an analysis of the new census data. Louisiana has the highest wage gap for black women. The wage gap is based on a comparison between the earnings of African-American women and Latinas working full-time and white, non-Hispanic men across the country. Iranian demonstrators gathered outside government buildings in Isfahan and Tehran to protest the recent spate of acid attacks on women, the International Business Times reported October 22nd. Security forces reportedly tried to disperse the demonstration at the Iranian Parliament building in Isfahan, calling it a political gathering. In the past 2 weeks, about a dozen women have had sulfuric acid thrown on their faces and bodies by a group of motorcyclists. It is widely believed that the women were targeted for not complying with the Islamic dress code in public places.
Our guest today on Every Woman is Wendy Doyle, President and CEO of the Women's Foundation of Greater Kansas City. And they have expanded their mission and have a lot of exciting work to tell us about. Prior to coming to the Women's Foundation, Wendy was for 8 years with Catholic Charities in Northeast Kansas. So she has a large background in nonprofit management. Welcome, Wendy, to Every Woman.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, when I first heard of the Women's Foundation, it was more or less an endowment fund that was granting to women, worthy women's organizations, sums of money on an annual basis, and they were in a money-raising mode. But you've expanded since then.
Yes, we have. Celebrating 24 years, so think about establishing the organization in 1991. The foundation was really established based on a research study looking at where philanthropic dollars were going in our community and recognizing at that point that only 4% of all charitable giving was going to support women and girls organizations or programs. And so based on that study, the organization launched really to empower women to be philanthropists in their own right, recognizing that women could make choices and decisions on where their gifts were going into the community. And we celebrate that and continue to do so today. So our establishment of an endowment and being able to grant funds back out into the community is still a significant part of our mission, and we certainly want to celebrate that. But we are looking at holistically where we can make change and we can close the gap, and we recognize that there was more that we could and should be doing in addition to grant making. So we have evolved into focusing more on research, so bringing forward issues and letting the data and facts accurately tell the story through the research. And then utilizing the research to guide us in our grant-making decisions, but also utilizing the research to develop a public policy platform. And we believe this is the model that we can really move the needle to get systemic change.
And I understand that due to your research, you found out that women in Missouri make typically 71 cents on the dollar to the national average of 77, 78 cents for the same job, the same position.
Absolutely. We recently completed a pretty monumental study on the status of women in the state of Missouri. And what we learned through this is that it's probably been about 20 years since such a significant study had been completed. We partnered with University of Missouri, the Public Policy Institute there, and we started this journey last summer, and we began by doing focus groups around the state so we could clearly hear the issues that women and families are dealing with. And we did focus groups in Kansas City, Springfield, and St. Louis. We profiled low-income women and mid- to upper-income women, and we even did a focus group of men to ask them what the issues that they're seeing impact women in their lives, but also what they think are impacting women. And as a result of this study, we targeted five key indicators after listening to women, and the indicators are income and employment, child care, health care, aging and economic security, and leadership. And the pay equity component falls under income and employment. And as a result of that, you know, we recognized that in the state of Missouri, 71 cents of every dollar on average is compared to what a man makes for every dollar. I will say in Carroll County, Missouri, it's 51 cents to the dollar that men make. So you can see that the average is really skewed, but it's in every single county in the state of Missouri, women are behind what men make.
Well, I suppose I'm kind of stunned by that, because I would not have thought there would have been that great, because I never thought about it, I suppose. If one thinks about it, I suppose that's normal, that where you can get away with it, you will.
Yes.
No one's watching.
Yes. And most recently, what the Women's Foundation has done, Representative Stephen Weber is a House of Representatives based out of Columbia, Missouri. And we gained some media attention as a result of releasing our study. And he took a look at it, and then he wanted to do something. So as a result, he introduced, filed a bill, House Bill 44, in the state of Missouri, and that bill calls for the Department of Labor to look at, do a little bit more research, do a study, but also as a result of it, come out with some best practices and some guidelines that private businesses and the government could utilize to help close that pay gap. So what we like about it is that it's really on point with our mission. We want our research to be relevant, be available to everyone. As a result, with University of Missouri, we placed our research on an interactive web-based platform. And so what that means is that those five key indicators that I previously mentioned, it's accessible to anyone at any time, but the data will always be relevant and updated in real time. So as new facts and data become available, our research will be updated as well. What we liked about it is that you can break it down by city, by county, by congressional district. It has the ability to even get breakdown on a street level. So you could apply those five key indicators to actually your street that you live on. So it's very interactive.
Is there a visible difference between, say, a low-income working woman and a professional high-income working woman?
That's a great question. What we found in our research is that, question from testifying in the committees, they asked, what occupation are you seeing the biggest pay gap? And I think that's the first place to start. And it was retail, education, healthcare. And more of the entry-level positions tend to see a wider pay gap than those that are progressing in their career. So you see that pay gap close a little further as you progress in your career, but it's really the big gap on that front end as you enter the job market.
And is that a Missouri-specific thing? Because I've seen national studies that show that the entry-level positions have a narrower pay gap and that the gap expands as the career progresses.
You know, it's really a case-by-case, and what we found is it's really by occupation. So you see it in retail significantly, healthcare professions, but as you broaden out into other occupations, it's different. So that's one of the things that this study, that this legislative introduction would look at, particularly for the state of Missouri, and have the Department of Labor really identify where those pay gap areas are.
And we know, we know what minimum wage is primarily, or somewhere in the $7 and what, 35 cents an hour in Missouri, I think. What would you guys believe is a living wage for someone?
We haven't really taken a look at that from a research perspective yet. What we really focused on is just looking at the pay gap. That would be a next step for us to look at taking a deeper dive now that we've brought forward the issues. But we haven't taken a deep dive on that. But that is something that we need to look at.
Do you think that we'll see a bigger living wage gap between men and women, with women having to be caregivers or
you know what, that is a great point and something that we did look at, and why one of the key indicators that we identified is aging. And what we're seeing is, you know, women live longer. Women typically have to step out of the workforce when they start families, and then make that decision on, you know, child care. We heard loud and clear from women is such a significant issue impacting family budgets, and making families having to make decisions. Do the men stay home and take care of the kids? Do the women, because of how expensive child care is? So on the back end, with women living longer, you know, it is a significant issue. So very good point.
And is this research going to develop into a little bit more of a look at those expenses? Because the income is only part of the equation, and the expense is this other piece, and in particular, child care, as something that will push women out of the workforce just because the cost is prohibitive, is that something that's affecting the pay gap?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, great point. What we found through our research study is that Missouri is the only state in the country that doesn't have a quality rating system. So first and foremost, we heard from low-income and mid to upper-income women accessibility to child care, as well as cost, but also quality. You're always looking to put your child in the best hands as you journey and go to work for the day. So quality rating system, the state of Missouri does not have one. And so that is something that we want to start with first of let's get certified and licensing requirements in place, but also a quality rating system for our child care providers.
Is that going to make child care more expensive?
That's a, you know, to be determined. You know, it's probably a cause and effect. It's something that we haven't looked from a research perspective yet. But we first feel like, you know, let's get Missouri to be, you know, with all of the rest of the states, and let's get the quality rating system in place so we know, you know, who's providing that best child care. But yet, yes, it's a cause and effect. You're exactly right. If we have the quality rating system, do others fall out? And then does that drive the cost up? It's a great point.
What is the average cost to have a child cared for weekly now? Does anyone know?
Unfortunately, I don't know. I don't have those facts with me today, so I'm not 100% sure. I'm sure it's a case-by-case basis, too.
Yeah, I have no idea what the average is, but personally, from my shopping around for childcare, you're looking at $250 a week. And to put that in perspective, that's more than I pay in rent. So it's more than just a significant part of the budget. It's almost the entire budget.
I recently talked with a woman who net $1,000 a month, and I believe she had two children, and I'm not sure how she was able to survive. There must be some sort of help there from the state with food stamps or something. She was a checker in a grocery store, and her net take-home was $1,000 a month. So if she had to pay $250 a week in child care, where would that leave her?
You know, it's interesting because one of the things that we've discovered that we want to work on, it's on our radar, is what is commonly known as the cliff effect. So when a woman is in a position to take a pay raise at work, oftentimes she has to decline it because it could impact the subsidy to care for her family, in subsidy defined as, you know, food assistance, rent assistance, child care, or health assistance. And so there are thresholds. If you make too much money, then you lose your subsidy to care for your family. And so, you know, that's another kind of a next step of, after looking at this pay equity issue, you know, what is right to help women, you know, get out of poverty, take that next step, and be able to accept the pay raise. You would, is that you would think it should be more fair.
Well, and I think that's one of the arguments that you hear people make when they want to do away with social safety nets, that they hold people back from going for these better jobs, when the issue isn't the safety net's there. The issue is that the safety net has a sharp cutoff point instead of a lovely tapering little tail that leads them gently into being able to take a raise and maybe, you know, just have a decline in the amount of money they're getting in assistance that equals what they're getting in the pay raise, so that they have the ability, it's not even the incentive, but the ability to be able to make something more of themselves and to pursue, you know, a raise at their job, a promotion.
Exactly. I mean, it is, you know, again, it's that cause and effect, but we have to look at developing some solutions to help. You know, women want to lift themselves up. They want to be good role models for their children. They want a better life. But we're putting them in a situation where they, as you said, unfortunately can't get out. And so what the Women's Foundation would like to do is really look at, again, some facts and data, what that can, how we can come up with some solutions to close that gap, you know, and stair step, you know, women so that they can get out of that and make more money.
What kind of response have you been getting from this legislation? Is it being supported by other legislators in the Missouri State House? Because it seems like this is kind of your key starting point. We talked about a lot of issues that are going to be factors here, but the starting point is really being able to continue to look into it and continue to gather the data. So what's the response?
The response has been extremely positive, I will say. You know, having the opportunity to testify was a great honor, you know, testifying in the House. And then the following week, Senator Lavota introduced it in the Senate, the same bill. And that was yet another opportunity to be able to testify. Great support. Had Mayor James actually came out and wanted to go on the record with his team and support of this bill, as well as Mayor Slay from St. Louis. And then, of course, Attorney General Koster came out, too, in support of it. So lots of great support and energy around, yes, let's take a look at this. It's not an enforcement. It's just coming out with some best practice guidelines on how we can close the gap. But I think what I was most pleased about is the opportunity to really present in our testimony focusing on economic development and how, if we close the pay gap, it could really drive more dollars into the state, and that should be a win-win for men and women. And what we cited was if we did close the pay gap, that it could potentially drive $8 billion into the state. And we broke that down and talked about that could be 73 more weeks of food for a family, which is more than a year's worth, could be 8 more months of mortgage or utility payments, nearly 13 more months of rent, or 2,934 additional gallons of gas. So it's a dollar and cents strategy, and it's you know, we wanted to present the why, and it just makes sense.
Well, it seems like you shouldn't have to take too much time to convince people that women also like to spend money once they've made it.
Exactly. Good consumers.
It is interesting that women do make 80% of the purchase decisions in the household. I mean, that's been a statistic that's been out there for a long time. And so many people don't catch on to that, evidently.
Exactly. And one of the other things that we cited as a viewpoint is based on the general election of 2012, 65% of the voters were women coming out. So again, you know, 51% of the population of Missouri is women. So, you know, we have a voice here.
And every woman, we talk about that every week in our purpose statement that we read at the beginning of every show, about how important it is for us to work and vote toward full participation.
Great. That's absolutely right.
And so tell us a little bit about the grant. When's your luncheon coming up, or have you had your luncheon?
We held our luncheon in December. It's always the first Friday in December, so mark your calendars for December 2015. This past luncheon, we were fortunate to host Dr. Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, and she was quite a delight and really sent a great message, and it was a great celebration day. We actually utilized that to release the research study results, some of our key indicators, and that was a great day. So, yes, we continue to do that. That's an opportunity to help support the Women's Foundation, and as we stated earlier in the beginning, our grant making is still very significant to our mission and what we do. And so, yes, we're continuing to do great work.
And you have a deadline coming up on the applicants for the grant.
Yes, actually, it's Friday, April 3rd. And so, yes, anyone who has an interest in applying to us to support programs that impact women and girls, Friday, April 3rd. And their application is online, and you can access it at womens-foundation.org.
And typically, how many grants will you request, will you receive?
We receive, as you can imagine, a tremendous amount of requests. Obviously, much more than we're able to support, and it varies year by year. And the amount that we grant out also varies year by year. Last year, we were able to support a significant number of organizations, about over 20, impacting programs for women and girls, and so we'll see what this year looks like.
Okay. And now you mentioned that your study was on the website.
Yes.
How would someone get to the study and the work you're doing there with Missouri?
Yes, we have a research tab on our website that you can certainly access it, but you can, what it is based on is Community Commons at University of Missouri, and that'll take you, can link, and then that'll take you actually to the research hub. There's a significant amount of data, so be prepared.
Okay. What other question did I have? What other thing would you like to share with our listeners before you, while you have time? Anything we've overlooked?
I would say the only other thing to add is that we also do philanthropic education, and we have a girls' leadership program, and it is targeting young women in high school. And we have developed a partnership with Cotty College down in Nevada, Missouri, and they have helped us put together a leadership curriculum for young women, and it's been a great partnership. So we just completed receiving applications from girls, and it is a two-year program, but an opportunity for girls from urban, suburban, private, public schools to come together. They wouldn't have the opportunity to meet otherwise, and we teach them the philanthropic process on how to grant funds, how to be a good grantor, and then also to be able to have a leadership component to that as well.
Well, I hear you've been doing some work with the city as well.
Yes, we have a great partnership with Mayor Sly James, and what Women's Foundation did a year ago is we did a study with University of Kansas looking at what are the barriers and opportunities for women to become civically engaged. And the number one reason that we learned out of the study is that women want to be asked to become civically engaged. And then secondly, when they think about giving of their time, they think about their church, their school, a nonprofit organization, and to think about giving your time back civically is not top of mind. And so as a result of this study, we did this for Mayor Sly James, and then we came up with a solution, and we have launched the Appointments Project. And the Appointments Project is an opportunity for a woman to apply through the Women's Foundation's website. We review the application. We are a safe place for women to call and ask questions that they may not feel comfortable calling City Hall. And our objective is to get women placed on boards and commissions. So what we do is as positions or opportunities become available with the City of Kansas City, we submit applications to the mayor for his consideration for an appointment to a board or a commission. And we launched this last April, and I'm so pleased to say that we have had 11 appointments to date, from the Parks and Recreation Board to the Land Bank, and it's been extremely successful. And we really utilize this as a model, and then we are looking to expand it to other municipalities, including a statewide effort. So it's been a great partnership, a collaboration. Mayor James has been extremely supportive, and it's been working extremely well.
And while we've focused on Missouri, you also are spreading into Kansas, too, with the same work and the same research. So that's good for Kansas women, too.
Great point. Yes, we are getting ready to embark on a similar study, the status of women in Kansas, utilizing the same profile and model that we talked about today, of utilizing the research to then develop some policy agenda items. And we'll be prepared to do so for legislative session 2016 in Kansas. So we've got a bright future and a lot of work to do.
Thank you, Wendy Doyle, President and CEO of the Women's Foundation, and it's just amazing the spread that you have taken on, and I can concur with you that you've got a lot of work to do.
Thank you, Sharon and Amy. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Funding for KKFI provided by the Weekly Forum at All Souls UU Church. Each Sunday at 10 a.m., the forum will feature a discussion on community issues. All Souls UU Church is at 4501 Walnut Street, one block east of Main in Kansas City. More information is at allsoulskc.org.
Hi, this is Tamara Severance with Peaceworks of Kansas City, and we're proud to bestow the 2015 Chris and Lynn Cheatham Community Peace Award to KKFI. Congratulations, KKFI, for all that you do for our community. You certainly deserve this award.
I'm here today with State Representative Brandon Ellington and Miss E. They're here to talk to us about the organization Voices of the People. Welcome to the program today.
Hi.
How you doing today?
Now, can you just tell us a little bit about what Voices of the People is and what you do?
Yeah, Voices of the People was founded in 1999, and it was founded around the plea, political, legal, economic, and academic. So Voices of the People is consistently engaging the community around conscience-raising events. We also have free political and legal classes.
What does a political and legal class, what does that entail?
With the political classes, I typically teach those when I'm here in town, so in the summertime and in the fall time. And we have three different courses: comparative politics, political theory, and then state and federal government. That way people can understand the different levels of government. The legal classes this year are actually being taught by the Missouri Bar Association, and the Black Caucus got behind it, but this is something that originated with Voices of the People.
And what can people expect to learn at a class like this? What's the purpose, and how is it improving the community?
Well, in the political classes, you can expect to learn everything from comparative politics, which compares different countries and the way their political process is actually implemented. In the political theory class, you have basic political theory, so you have the beginning course where you start to understand political words, political ideologies, the different levels in the arena. With the legal classes, you can expect to get taught by judges and lawyers about the legal process, from everything from constitutional law to criminal law.
And how does somebody find out about how to participate in one of these classes?
Well, the legal classes right now is the second Tuesday of every month, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Mary Kelly Center. We have radio ads that's being currently played right now. You can also find it out by contacting Voices of the People. Area code 816-651-0044. You can also go to the website, voicesofthepeople.org. And you can go on Facebook to Voices of the People on Facebook.
And when you started this program, was there a specific community need that you were looking to address with this education program?
Well, the education program grew out of some of the conscious raising activities that we was trying to do with Voices of the People. When Voices of the People was first founded, it was founded around a lot of different issues that was happening in the community, some of which was police brutality. So the legal courses and the political courses came once we started understanding that a lot of people in poorer communities didn't understand their legal rights, nor did they understand the political arena and what agency or what institution they should be engaging to get different results and different changes in their community.
So there was police brutality in Kansas City?
Yeah, I know it sounds like an anomaly, but that's how we actually started. And from there, we've been able to grow by identifying and addressing different issues that are happening in the city, like with GURL, which came out of Voices of the People. She started doing domestic violence forums, and from the forums, she started doing various trainings when it comes to domestic violence, counseling, counselors, and also people that have been victims.
But when we speak of GYRL, we're speaking of giving yourself real love. And that was one of the organizations that was formed out of Voices of the People, because we realized that once the mothers was taken out of the homes for whatever reason, that the basis of our community was suffering in the urban core. So out of that came My Brother's Keeper, which formulated the men being back into the homes. And that generated us knowing that, learning that, that there was a desert of food, an empty desert of food where food was
a food desert, yeah.
Right. And so food wasn't amplified, so then we had built a community garden which was able to feed our people in our community that normally wouldn't get any fresh vegetables. So it's grown to be a whole list of things that Voices of the People have come under.
And are you starting to see improvements in the community just around things like having fresh produce and having good family support for women in particular with GYRL?
But we're seeing that it's a slow process, because once the system has beaten you down, it's a recovery process. We've been very thankful with men that have left our community just come back from being incarcerated through My Brother's Keeper to be able to start being the fathers that they needed to be in their homes, which helps a lot. But that's through Representative Ellington's efforts to go back into the community and pull people out to make them see that they are worthwhile and they can make a difference by running for political office. It's something that we never really believed in before, that the system could be changed politically.
How long have you been a representative for?
I was first elected in 2011 during a special election, and I've been representing ever since then.
And was your political career a result of your work with Voices of the People?
Yeah, it was a direct result of my work in the community. Like I said, we started Voices of the People in 1999. And the first issue was police brutality, but there's so many issues that is affecting the community that by me working in the community, working with Voices of the People and identifying different issues, it made me want to get more involved in the political process, because everything breaks down to policies and procedures.
And I think one of the things when you talk about Voices of the People coming, when we speak about voices, it involves the whole community. It has from the gay rights to the civil rights. And that's what makes us unique, because it's not looking at one gender of people. It's not saying black people have been discriminated against. It's saying we the people have been discriminated. So out of that, our political entity has been changed to start a party by Representative Ellington called We the People. And that involves the people getting involved in local and our state and government, which makes a big difference, because now the upcoming election is one of the results of that. We have four or five young people that decided that they want to run for city council, which is unique, because we've been told that it takes money, but it takes we the people to get out there to engage the people.
Walking and knocking and getting your word out there. And just having the courage to run once, do you see that people maybe have the courage to run again? Mm-hmm. I mean, having a support group really helps on stuff like that.
It helps a lot, especially when you take the dogmatic part out of the political arena, especially in Kansas City, when the politics in the urban core has been run by a specific a group that has been, you know, not doing us justice. And now you see people are tired, and they're coming together, and they're saying they're going across parties, and they're saying we want the best elected people involved in our government, which means that you just go there to represent us and not dictate to us.
And that has been what you've seen in the past from your government, is not speaking with the voice of the people.
The people giving up their rights. It's not the government took them. It's we sat back and we let it happen. You know, we got focused on different items. If, you know, we start looking around city, local city government, we see how the city government has not been in our favor for the working class people, especially for the women and minorities who have suffered under this government. You know, so it takes us to stand up and say, people like you, Annie, that we have to support the voice. And we have to make sure that the money is not running, that the big government is not running the local politics. So you have to get involved to find out how easy you can run. Representative Ellington was one of the candidates that they said could not run because he didn't have any major forces behind him. But he had the people, the will of the people, and we knocked on doors, you know, went to neighborhoods and got people involved in the process. And I think that's why he's so successful, is because he went down there with the heart of the people and continued to push their efforts. You know, what he's seen in his community, he went and spoke about it. And so he's engaged in the community. So I think we need more people like that involved in it.
Do you see a lot of people like that out in Jeff City?
No. Excuse me. But no, you don't. You don't see a lot of people like that anywhere.
He was too busy kind of sighing.
You know, he's still got to have friends when he go back. So.
You know, I know that you've done things like facilitate a community garden, which is probably more important than a lot of people realize. Mm-hmm. Those little things that just make it feel like a home. And you've also done things with helping people figure out how they can maybe get assistance getting a cell phone or other things that just helps with daily necessities of living. What kind of other work in that area have you been doing?
Well, I don't know if it's known, but we feed the homeless shelters once a month. We go in and we mentor and feed them. And also, that's on a daily, a monthly basis. Also, once a year, Representative Ellington has a basketball group that he puts together, a community group. And out of that money, out of the funds that we have or receive, the canned goods or whatever, we have been able to feed over 25,000 people. So we not only feed, we clothe. We do a lot of stuff that people don't know that we do, and we don't have any outside funds. So none of this money is coming from any entity other than the people. And so that's what makes it so unique, because the people buy back into the system. We have two facilities that we're trying to get up and running for this summer, and that's on our motto block project on 38th and Chestnut, where we will be able to take the homeless, we'll be able to take the mothers on welfare, the kids that are not eating, and give them art therapy. So, and that's no cost to the community. It's run by volunteers. So Voices of the People is just that, is Voices of the People, from domestic violence that has ruined in our community, because one out of three of the women that are domestic violence in the urban core will not survive it. Mentally, physically, or emotionally.
One out of three.
One out of three, and mostly the ones will die. Because by the time a minority is reported, she's dead. Because that's something that we don't report in our community. It's called, and we're calling it breaking the silence.
There must be some silence, because that's just a shocking number to me, and a very frightening number
to
me.
If you look at just recently in the news, the three women that were attacked this week, what was the result of their outcome? You know, nobody's really talking about the things, because a lot of these things are underreported, and they're not reported. In the urban core, it's not reported like it is outside, because it's expected to happen in this, and it's kept secret. You know, because all the things that happen, child molestation, abuse, physical, mentally, sexually, is rampant. And if we don't talk about it, and we're breaking the silence, and this is why it's so important that we get the word out, and that's why I fight so hard on Facebook, because if you look at the schools, it's a result of the home, the parenting. The two children that were molested at Truce Elementary School, they were told, the mothers were told, that they could not even get the names of the man that was that molested their children. And it was okay, and they left. This is the lack of information of your knowing your rights. And this is our children that are molested in our schools, raped in our schools. Southwest with the rapes that occurred over there. Nobody's talking about this because they don't know their rights. And so this is why we fight so hard, to let them know that this abuse is taking place in our community. And it has to stop. It has to at least have a face on it. And that's why we ask people to help us to get the word out about GYRL, and not just the domestic violence part of it, but how we're trying to restore our homes. You know, because how do you restore a home when everybody in there has been broken? You know, everybody is in there suffering some kind of way. You know, the mother has been taken through and abused. The husband has been abused and violated. So what chance do you have for our community?
Well, that was actually one of my next questions. Is it a struggle to keep people committed to the community instead of just leaving when they get the chance? Just leaving this place that they're struggling in, instead of staying there like you're doing and really trying to come together and bring the community to a better place.
That's why we start with the conscious building aspect of it. Because the minute you start to understand the differences between institutions, what resources the institutions should be bringing to you, you have a different understanding of where you want to live, the type of social and economic opportunities that you can have in your own community, as opposed to moving to a community that is not germane with your culture, where you're from, and you have to start over. So the more that we raise the consciousness, and culture is different than ethnicity and different than race, so the more we raise the consciousness, the more you see the retention level of people not only involved with the groups, but people in the community, because they understand the value of the resources that are around them and how to access those.
You know, I think that's one of the things when we talk about being social conscious. I think that's one of the reasons why I get so upset when we talk about what events that happened on the plaza. Because the events that happened on the plaza, they pin minority kids against not being there. But if you look in the community, especially where we're at on 38th and Chestnut, the nearest facility for the children to play is like 5 miles away. So that means your child has no opportunity to ride a bike because there's no sidewalks, you know.
Well, I just wanted to comment on the plaza thing. I lived on the plaza when that whole thing went down, and the idea that they were pinning that on minority youth was ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. There wasn't a problem with kids down there. They were so mean to kids down there, the security would just throw them out the first chance they got. I mean, anybody that looked like they were under 40 was basically stopped and given trouble, and especially if they were a minority. I mean,
watched that the other day. When we have the St. Patrick Day parade, we're looking at a whole group of young people now under 40 that come together because they want to come together. They don't have the racial tension that their parents might have had. And I think the truth be told, a lot of that was because the black guys were flirting with the white girls from Johnson County, and they were coming in and they were doing, you know, getting drunk and doing a lot of that stuff. So we have to, the parents were the cupid of that. You know, children will be children, but just to say that we're going to take our city funds and protect the plaza, we have a whole east side. They can't get patrol cars over there, you know. But during that period of night, if it's warm, all our patrol is going to go west.
Well, and I will say, too, that even when there were so-called riots down on the plaza, and I had my car down there and all of that stuff, those riots came and went, and I was right there, didn't even know it was happening. But Thanksgiving night, property damage, it's terrible. And this is a well-sanctioned party, and that they just destroyed the place.
Yeah.
So the narrative there is, someone who lived down there, it didn't really add up.
Well, it's because it wants to keep racism alive. And the people have to know what it is, you know, calling for what it is. Racism makes a lot of money. Kansas City, Missouri, was the last state to be freed. And it still is. We have corporate, you know, racism now. It's blunted. But I don't see the same results from the kids under 40 as their parents. So they want to make them enemies. But when we talk about the kids on the east side, and the reason why they always talk about the east side is because none of the amenities is over there. We don't have skating rinks. We don't have art shows, you know, art places to go or develop culture. They have no way to go and dance. You know, it's nothing east of truth. And so if you want your kid to grow up children are a product of their environment. What they see is what they get and what they hope to be. I was very blessed. I'm Brandon's mother. In order for him to grow up to want something different, but Brandon grew up with a conscious heart of community, and that's where it started. It didn't just start that he grew up one day and he wanted to feed the community. He fed the community and sacrificed when he was a child, you know, when he would give up his toys and he would do this. So we have to raise our children to be what we want them to be.
And he's now in turn bringing his children and showing them what it means to speak out, and that's a really positive cycle for a kid to grow
up. He's passing that baton down to his children to let them see the sacrifices that they're privileged. And when I mean privileged, to be loved by your parent and have a whole parent in the urban core is a privilege. To have a father present in your life is a privilege. You know, it should not be a privilege. It should be every child's right to have their parents to be there to love them. But in our society today, it's a privilege. You know, it's a blessing. And other men are following him. So it's not just him. He has other friends that are following his footsteps now. Some that thought that they could not be the perfect father, which whatever a perfect father is, but they're there for their children. So we're seeing a turnabout in that course. Wouldn't you say, Brandon?
Well, as you're kind of seeing all of these changes happen and finding new areas that maybe people need a little assistance here and there, are you just kind of developing new programs to help the community as you go along? Just when you hear people say we have a need, look at it and address it, or do you have kind of...
I don't think we started any new programs because this is what we've been grounded on. I think it just comes around because we don't change because society's changing. The moral value of a home is the same. So the makeup of what we believed in from the very beginning, from the core, is still there. And I think this is why we've been very successful and been able to people to believe in us, because we don't change because the times have changed. You know, we're trying to not bring back, but we just try to reestablish the values in which we know that we have as a people.
And where do you see the Kansas City community as a whole heading right now? Is there a good outcome on the horizon?
I started to say something, but I'm not going to be optimistic. But I think if people don't start getting involved, I think that they might as well say that Hitler exists. I think that if people don't start paying attention, they're gonna create their own riots, which we have seen in Ferguson, Missouri. They're gonna pit that when you take education out of a school, you start slavery. So we're just going back to the very beginning of where we come from. You know, now we know a little bit more, but we know nothing. You know, so if we don't, as a people, start getting involved in our local government, we're just headed towards just a new plantation, just like the. They built downtown in the River Keys. They put the new prison system down there. And most people don't even know it's there, you know, that they have a prison built downtown.
Is this one of those private prisons?
Yes. Didn't it? It came from, where
no.
is it? Which
no.
one is it?
No. It was a department change. It went from a halfway house to, I believe, like a level one or a level two. It's not a private prison. It's a state-run facility. The only thing that it did was switch out the probation and parole aspect of it.
But people don't even know it's
there. They didn't create no new penitentiary.
But people don't know it's downtown. It's down in the bottom.
And did they switch that because there was a need for more prison space? Because that is typically a red flag. When they're filling up prisons, that's a red flag.
Well, no, because it's not a prison like Chillicothe or JCCC or anything like that. What they did is they have level one and level two offenders in there, and they removed the halfway house. So it's the exact same facility. They just switched the type of offenders that are in that facility.
But I think, Brandon, what we're saying is when they brought it downtown instead of putting business
It was already downtown. So that's the thing. You know, it would be different if it was something new that was being put down there. So you took out one set of offenders, which was offenders that just got out of the correctional institution. You're allowing offenders that are currently in the correctional institutions to go down there now. Offenders that are currently in the correctional institution to go down there now. So it's not a new build. It's not bringing in different folks that wasn't already having access to it. It's just a difference in the process or where they're at in serving their time.
How come we didn't know it was there?
You did. You just mentioned it.
No, I just found out it was there. I didn't know it was there.
That wouldn't be a city issue. That would be a DLC, Department of Corrections issue. Departments, like the Department of Corrections, since it's a DLC facility, they can switch in and out. And I don't think they're required to give any type of public awareness because it's not nothing new coming into the community. It'd be different if it was something new coming into the community.
Well, but that is an example of how challenging it can be to be involved in your community at times because they have this facility on the books for X number of years. They just assume that you're going to know about it, even though they never talked to you about it at any point that you can remember in your lifetime, but you're supposed to know that it's there somehow.
Well, no, it depends. So if we was talking about a standard neighborhood, because we're talking about the West Bottoms, and we're talking about communities, right? So if we're talking about a regular neighborhood, you can't change a duplex that is created for a halfway house without getting community buy-in. You couldn't change a facility in the middle of a community to be a business without getting corresponding buy-in from the community. So when we talk about it, we have to be transparent about what we're talking about. If it was in the middle of a neighborhood, everybody would have been identified.
I don't know if that's actually true. That would be the politically correct way. But what I just heard at one of the forums today, that they're trying to pass this ordinance, so that they're able to come in and tear down houses because they want to. You know, that's saying a whole lot. So they didn't ask for public opinion on that.
Tearing down houses in
the third district.
Well, again, it's being transparent and understanding the words and the conversation that's out there. So the ordinance, the potential ordinance that she's talking about would be a city ordinance. So it wouldn't give contractors the ability to come down and tear down a family-owned house. It would give them the ability to tear down a house that has been a burden on the city. Now, I'm not saying I agree with the ordinance. I'm just saying that wordage and understanding.
That's not what he was stating. What he stated today is any house. This is what Jermaine Reed stated, that any house that they wanted to tear down that was vacant and abandoned, that they could do it without having to.
Okay, and regardless of what Councilman Reed said, this is why it's important to understand the law, because the law and people's opinions or people's misinterpretations of language and ordinances isn't always true. So if the law dictates that you can't have eminent domain where you just tear down people's houses to tear down people's houses, you aren't going to see a influx of houses getting tore down at random will, because that's illegal.
Well, and I think that might be a subject that you cover in some of these classes that you do. So if you want to tell everybody one more time where they can find out more about this.
Yeah, the second Tuesday of every month, we're doing free legal classes right now at the Mary Kelly Center, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. During the summer, we'll start back up with the political classes. But right now, the second Tuesday of every month, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., the Mary Kelly Center.
Well, thank you, Representative Ellington and Ms. E, for coming in to talk with us about Voices of the People. And I hope to hear another positive progress report here in the upcoming month.
Thank you.
Because they in the hallway.
Thank you for listening to Every Woman today. This is Amy Bell, and make sure you stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf and Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson.